Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. And members, we have a full next 3 weeks because it's deadline time. And I just want to remind everyone to be civil when you're asking questions and responding to answers. I think our committee is doing a really good job with that. And just want to remind members to do that. We're going to take the roll first. Ms. Hansen, chair present.
Schultz present. Vice Chair Bonner.
Bonner present.
Thank you. Oh, hold on. I'm going to let a couple more people in. There they are. Lead Albright just joined us. Representative Bolden.
Bolden present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Keel present.
Good to see you yesterday, Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins. Oh, she's here in the waiting room. Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you, members. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and we do have a quorum. Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes from March 17th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Okay, members, please unmute yourself for a voice vote. Representative Albright moves the minutes from March 17th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, members, the first bill on our agenda is Representative Winkler. Let me see if he's with us. Not seeing him.
He just entered the waiting room.
Okay.
Chair Schultz.
Give us 1 second. Sorry, I apologize for this delay. Okay, Representative Winkler, we are ready for your bill. Welcome to the committee. The first item is House File 3405. I'll make the motion to lay over House File 3405 to be for possible inclusion in the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Omnibus Bill. I'm not seeing any amendments, Representative Winkler, so please describe your bill, and then we'll move to testifiers and then take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for taking the time to hear this bill today. House File 3405 is an innovative approach to addressing wage disparities, to addressing working conditions that are challenging for workers, and for addressing the need for long-term support for our long-term care industry, specifically nursing homes. The bill creates a 9-person board, 3 individuals representing state agencies, 3 individuals representing the nursing home industry, and 3 individuals representing workers. The board is delegated with state authority to set wages, working conditions, and benefits in Minnesota using its general police power. So the state has authority to set a minimum wage. It has authority to ban child labor or to restrict the number of hours a worker can be compelled to work in 1 week and to set workplace safety standards. That authority is vested in the state's general power to regulate business, commercial, and other affairs in the state of Minnesota. So we are delegating that authority to a board where workers, where the nursing home industry, and where state agencies can together set working conditions so that workers are represented and have their views included in those conversations, where the industry can point out shortcomings in funding or the need to find other ways to secure a workplace that is stable and consistent. And so state agencies can address their role in funding regulating and other roles in making sure that the long-term care industry is viable. Together, that board has the authority to set those powers, to set those standards using the powers of the state. It's an old concept that came out of the Progressive Era and the Great Depression, updated for the needs of this industry at this time. And Madam Chair, there are a couple of testifiers, and that wraps up my opening comments.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. I'll go to the testifiers now. The first testifier we have is Julius Nikandi. Welcome to the committee. Please state Thanks. Your name and your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you. Chair Schulze and members of the committee, my name is Julius Nikandi. I'm a nursing assistant, and I work at the Mission Nursing Home in Plymouth. I live in Andover, and I'm a union steward with SEIU. Our union represents 50,000 health workers, and I encourage you to support this bill. It is the only way to overcome our workforce crisis and build the workforce that can survive the next pandemic. I first started working at the Mission Care Center in 2004. I've worked there for almost 20 years now. And before COVID-19, our nursing assistant started at $13.89 an hour. More than a year in the COVID-19 pandemic, the nursing assistant starting wage had only gone up to $14.15 an hour. After more than a year of death, our starting wages were still lower than many fast food places. As a long-term employee, when COVID started, I got a raise of 32 cents. After almost a year of COVID, I got a raise of 35 cents. Those wages increases are not enough to keep staff. Our most recent contract was better, but I still must work extra hours all the time to make ends meet. I always struggle to provide for my 5 children. Since the COVID-19 pandemic started, too many people have left the industry. Half of my friends quit. Some left because they were afraid of catching COVID-19. Almost half the people I work with got sick. For months, we had nothing more than surgical masks. After we got N19 masks, we had to ration them. Every day, I was worried I would bring COVID home to my family. For 2 years, I spent most of my time at home alone in my room. If a fetal illness threatens you and your family, why risk so much for a job that pays so little? When my coworkers started looking for other employment, they were surprised to find that other jobs paid so much better. We thought we were doing critical work, but so many other people made so much more driving trucks or delivering food. When someone finds a better paying job, everybody at work talks about it and our morale sinks. People feel like they are fools for sticking with the industry. Even worse, working short-staffed takes away the pride I took in my work. My workload is unbearable. Instead of taking care of 10 residents, I'm now caring for 15 or more. We rarely get new workers to replace those that leave. If we do, they don't last long. I can't complete my tasks. I should. Every day I feel depressed when I end my shift because I know I should have done more. I don't have time for important things that matter so much to my residents. I've given 20 years to this industry. The employers have had 20 years or more to build a workforce that could survive this crisis. We need tens of thousands of new workers to attract people and to keep them during a crisis We need an industry-wide minimum wage, pay scales that reward experienced workers, affordable health insurance, and even pensions. Workers only get this when they have a seat at the table to set industry standards. Please give us the tools to save this industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nyakundi, and thank you so much for working and providing care to people's loved ones in your nursing facility you work at in Plymouth. We really value and appreciate you. And, you know, I have committed to making sure that we value people in the caring profession, and we show that by paying livable wages. So thank you so much for coming to testify today. And please stick around if there are questions. The next testifier I have is Jackie Levine. Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name, your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jacqueline Levine. I live in Brooklyn Park, and I am a licensed practical nurse. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Yep, please proceed.
Okay. And I live in Brooklyn Park, and I work at the Villa at Bryn Mawr. I have been working there since 1989. I went there as a pool agency nurse, and they kept asking me to stay, and I've been there that long. What I like most about my job is the patients. The patients who I care for, I always have a good bond with them. And my staff also, I have a good bond with. They love and respect me too, and we have a good relationship. But the hardest part of this job is we always down staff. Before COVID, we were shut, and we used agency. I was sick with COVID for 3 months, and those that called me told me also that they were shutter than before COVID. Now that we are past the first 2 years, it is still shut. Sometimes we have one staff when we're supposed to have three on that floor. They also hire people, but as many come, right after orientation, they will leave. And the number one cause is pay, especially for nursing assistants. No one wants to come and stay there and work for $16 when other places are paying more. I have been there so long that I am one of those that know more about nursing home too for the many years I have put in. And the best way that we can raise our pay is to give worker a voice on the job. That's why I am urging you to support HOSFA 3405. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Levine, for providing testimony today and also for working and caring for our loved ones in Minnesota and for doing it without the wages you need to support your family. Hopefully we can correct that in the future. Let's see, are there any questions for the bill author, Representative Winkler, or for the testifiers? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome to the committee, Representative Winkler. I'm looking at the bill itself, and I'm curious about some of the provisions in it, and I'm wondering if you could expound on. The first one I will draw your attention to is subdivision 2 on page 6, where it talks about every 2 years the board will seek to adopt minimum nursing home employment standards that meet or exceed existing industry conditions. I'm just wondering, upon what basis is the board going to also then, if they set those minimum standards, seek to obviously probably meet or exceed the prevailing wage for that industry, How then are you going to provide for that through a new reimbursement rate at the state or federal level?
Representative Winkler, you could answer that. We also have Brian Elliott available to answer questions. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, the board would take into consideration reimbursement rates, funding levels, and so forth provided for to the industry. And I think it's important to state again, the board consists of 3 members representing workers, 3 members representing the industry, and 3 representatives, three individuals representing state agencies. So it would be well-versed in funding levels and the economic conditions in the nursing home industry when it was setting wages and benefit standards.
Representative Albright.
Well, it's curious in the answer, Representative Winkler, and I thank you for it. But so what you're saying is that if they identify that there's no meaningful way to get reimbursement rates higher, then the work of the board is to basically identify that rates have to stay where they are for the wages that are provided to the employees.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the board has no authority over state funding of this industry. The legislature and the governor have that authority. The board would take into consideration the financial reality of the industry and state funding when it set working conditions and rates. The benefit of the board is that workers have a seat at the table for discussing these changes and have a role in problem solving on wages, working conditions, benefits, and so forth in the industry, so that as they look at the amount of funding available, whether it's high or low or wherever it might be, they then can set working conditions for the industry accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Albright, final question, and then we'll go to Representative Keel, and then we can come back to you at the end if you have questions of
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Keel. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, I want to draw your attention to page 9 of your bill where it talks about the training that is required every 6 months by a certified worker organization. And even though the employer may provide it on site, they're still obligated to provide it off-site if that's the case and pay the worker. But it even goes so far as then that you're asking for the employer to provide the names of all those in attendance to the certified worker organization at the conclusion of it. What purpose is that for?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the purpose is so that the certified worker organization has an opportunity to answer questions, provide any follow-up to make sure that the individuals can ask questions and so forth. That is the sole reason why that information is provided.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. We'll go to Representative Keel now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I was going to ask a little bit more about this certification for training. Actually, I have had some experience in being trained before we had CNAs, Certified Nursing Assistants. And my experience with nursing homes tells me that the best training is at action in the facility itself. That helps you to learn in the facility and learn the patients, get to know who they are. It's more about a personality sometimes than it is about the physical work that you do. My concern is that we're training, we're demanding so much higher training than most of our nursing homes already provide. So are we duplicating something that we can't, I don't think we can even afford to do, but how would we cover all that? And why would we be duplicating it?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, if you would look at page 7, lines 23, onto page 8, and down, you will see the curriculum for this training. The training is focused not on how to serve patients or to provide care. The training is about how to have a voice in the workplace, what your rights are, how to be engaged in conversations about retaliation and so forth. So it's about workers being trained in how to actively participate with their voice in the workplace.
Hmm. Representative Keel.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to point out to you and the testifiers that the state has actually not been very helpful when advising workers and reviewing them. And so would this also teach employees how to stand up for themselves when the state comes in and accuses them of poor care or, I won't even cite the explanations. I just know that this happens regularly.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, there would be no reason why this training could not also provide workers with information about their rights under the law in cases of investigations by regulators.
Representative Keel, final question.
I just have some real fears about how this is going to be financed, and I think in the end that what our testifiers want is going to implode. And nursing homes are going to be non-existent. And if you think you have problems in the cities employing, we've been having these problems long before COVID, long before. And so I, as a rural member, this would be really, I agree that CNAs should be, staff in general, nurses in general need to be paid. It is a hard job and sometimes a thankless job to take care of our loved ones, but there is a reality that we need nursing homes. So I have some real concerns about this.
Thank you. Well, I'll just add that we have excellent training at the University of Minnesota Carlson School in terms of labor relations and labor advocacy. And so I think that's been a very successful program for workers. Also, I think this bill with the board, it would, as a former chair of long-term care and aging, it would give us more information and have workers be at the table so they can contribute information to legislators. So I support this bill. Representative Albert, I see your hand up. Just one, if you have a final comment or question, I will allow one, and then we need to move on for time. Representative Albright.
I won't so much have a question for the author of the bill as far as just some comments. I've seen articles on this in terms of work done much like this in Michigan and Nevada. And while, you know, there are some interesting and intriguing components to the bill that Representative Winkler has presented here, they seem certainly to be much more invasive and long-term in nature than the provisions that both Nevada and Michigan put in place because of, to your testifiers' words, the ramifications brought on by COVID. Madam Chair, you know, it is a bit confusing to me, and I won't press the point anymore, but 3 years ago, your party pushed a reduction in.
Yeah, I'm not, Representative Albright, I have to cut you off. I don't want to talk about what we've done in the past on VBR. That is not related to this bill. So if you can move beyond that, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, this bill has no Senate author, and I won't impugn the motives of the author himself, but I don't think this is going very far. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much, Representative Albright. And, you know, I just want to say it's been a priority for me and my caucus members and our committees to prioritize addressing the healthcare workforce shortage. And that means we do need to look at reimbursement rates. So I hope that we can get support to making sure that we're paying living wages in the caring professions as a priority this session. Closing comments, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the questions and conversation today. I think it's an important topic to dive into. I certainly would think that as we look at increasing funding for long-term care. We make sure that workers have a seat at the table in deciding how those funds will be paid out to help workers, the kind of working conditions, the kind of hours that they have. And I think all industries, but especially this industry, is well served by having the voice of workers at a table where they can have a conversation with employers and with the state about how to improve the industry and make sure that the workforce is supported and available in the long run. That's the goal of this bill. And I ask you to include it in your omnibus bill in partnership with whatever you might do for funding.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. I'm not seeing any questions. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Thanks again, testifiers, and thank you, Representative Winkler, for advocating for the bill. Okay, members, the next bill we have on the agenda is House File 4192, and we have Representative Keeler with us. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Keeler. Great to see you. I'm going to move to adopt the division report from Preventing Homelessness Division for House File 4192. Members, this is a voice vote, so please unmute. All those in favor of adopting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And my motion will be to place House File 4192 as recommended on the general register. Please explain your bill, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is really basic. Last session, we passed House File 900, which created the Shelter Task Force. It brings a group of people together that talks about the needs around shelter. What this bill does is it just extends the final reporting date. In the original bill, we had stated August 31st after the task force has started. There's obviously more that they want to uncover and create information for us. And so what this bill does is it just extends that final reporting date to be December 15th. That's all the bill does, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Such a simple bill. We'd like to get those at this committee. Any questions for Representative Keeler? We don't have testifiers. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Keeler, why the extension?
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, it's something that the task force came to us when we checked in with them. I think that it took a little bit longer for them to get going just with the technology and COVID, and keeping in mind that some of the people who are on this task force are actually individuals who have lived experience with homelessness. So I think there were just some barriers getting everybody to the table to really start this conversation. And I just believe that when our community asks us for more time to give us more information for us to make informed decisions, we do that for them.
Yes, and there was a pandemic, so I know things get delayed during a pandemic, and I'm not sure if that's a reason. But Representative Albright, one more question, then we need to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for you, Madam Chair, or it might be for the author of the bill, but this does relate to housing, and I'm curious as to why this bill was referred to us as opposed to housing, and is there a definition in terms of the size of the scope of the bill that it would fall under DHS as opposed to or housing committee as opposed to homeless. I'm just curious why we're hearing this bill and not seeing it move forward through another committee.
Yes, Representative Albright, it was heard and vetted in the homelessness division, and that was a leadership decision on where to send this bill, and I think that was the appropriate committee. Representative Keeler, do you have anything to contribute to
that?
Thank
you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. I think where this comes from is, I don't know if you remember that when Preventing Homelessness originally was created, it was under housing. We quickly realized that actually what Preventing Homelessness is a human service industry. And so what this task force is doing is actually looking at the human service side of shelter, not the structure or brick and mortar side of shelter. So that's why I believe that it's housed under this committee versus housing.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Not seeing any other questions. So this is going to be a roll call vote, members. So I'm going to renew my motion to place House File 4192 as recommended on the general register. Ms. Hansen, can you please take the roll? The chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Albright, aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Walden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Thank you. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Thank you. Representative Moeller?
Moeller, aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Thank you, sir. That's 19 ayes and 0 nays, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Ms. Hansen. So the motion prevails, and House File 4192 is on its way to the General Register as recommended. Thank you so much, Representative Keeler. We appreciate it. Okay, members, next bill we have is House File 3845. Representative Hansen, would you like to make the motion to re-refer House File 3845 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. That's my motion.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves to refer House File 3845 to Judiciary. And I'm not seeing any amendments, so please explain your bill to members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. You've heard me talk a little bit about some needs to improve our foster care system, so I'm going to build on some of those other conversations we've had. HF 3845 seeks to create an office of a youth foster ombudsperson. Children in foster care face critically important issues, and they deserve to be represented, served, and protected like all the other children in our state. Youth in foster care do not always have a resource or an avenue for intervention when they face abuse or neglect at the hands of our very own system. Navigating the foster care system alone is a challenging task, to say the least, and without the appropriate tools and advocates, we will continue to allow some common cycles of hurt and trauma that we are seeing in our communities. And like I said, we have other bills that are looking to address some of the challenges in our child welfare system. But in this space for this bill, I just want to reiterate some of the things you may have heard me say before. In Minnesota in 2020, American Indian and Indigenous children were 16.4 times more likely than white children to be removed from their homes. African American and Black children were 2.4 times more likely to be removed than white children. And children of two or more races were 6.8 times more likely to be removed than white children. The disparities for Indigenous kids and families are some of the worst in the nation. And some of us see too many similarities between today's child protection system and boarding schools of the past. This system is riddled by bias, and we're working to address this through these other bills, but this office is another tool in the toolbox for this overall initiative. This office aims to provide oversight for the systems that are tasked with protecting Minnesota's children from harm and to create a pathway to adequately track the issues affecting young people in foster care in Minnesota. As it stands, there are no organizations or entities that track complaints or common concerns that arise for youth in foster care. And without this data, we are left without the critically important information that we need and value to inform the changes that we must make. While we, of course, have some data that gives us glimpses into the system overall, the lack of more means that we're lacking that ability to make data-informed decisions as we work to protect kids and implement meaningful changes that they need. Establishing this office will promote equity, equal opportunity for more kids in the foster population. Although this will not address all of the needs of youth foster care, we know that, this office will make sure that more youth in foster care have more access to the critical resources that they need, and that they'll have an advocate to help them resolve issues, and it will give more visibility for the need for change by this important system. Members, by establishing this office, we are creating an organizational structure that will create positive change. It's going to allow for more capacity to do independent investigations and track areas where significant interventions are needed. This office would positively affect Minnesota's child welfare system by increasingly addressing the intersecting issues youth often face in foster care, such as housing and homelessness, substance use, abuse, neglect, and more. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I would turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So we have with us Mr. Murphy. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Huang Murphy, and I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit called Foster Advocates. It's not just our name, it's what we do. We foster advocacy with young people who have been impacted by Minnesota's foster care system. I founded the organization in 2018 based on an audacious idea that child welfare systems change could and should be led by people most impacted. Since then, we have engaged with fosters across the state. And, you know, I really must apologize because while I deeply wish this was a chance for me to tell you how great we are doing as a state, I'm sorry to inform all of you that we are not. Not by any reasonable measure of success. Upon reaching their 21st birthday, at a time that most of their peers are celebrating, fosters face a deep stability cliff as they lose financial and social support networks provided by the state. It's also no wonder that within a year of aging out, often 18-year-olds are experiencing 25 to 40% are homeless, about half to two-thirds experiencing homelessness within the first 4 years of aging out. In fact, experience in foster care is one of the most predictable factors of being homeless later in life. A recent survey of fosters in the Seven County Metro found that fosters ages 18 through 21, that 79% had experienced homelessness. When families are not safe or good places for children to be, the government intervenes. Who intervenes when it is the government that is causing the abuse? I think this begs a really basic question. Who is watching the watchers? Currently, no one. Children entrusted to our care must face the challenges of life on their own upon aging out. They shouldn't have to face the foster care system alone with no one to call for help. It doesn't have to be this way. We can do better for our young people. We must do better. Creating more opportunity for the Ombuds Office to lead meaningful change and improve systemic issues plaguing the child welfare system in Minnesota. This will have a trickle-down effect for the state's child welfare system by anticipating and fixing issues that otherwise may lead to endangerment of foster youth, as well as curbing any potential lawsuits by former and current foster youth. Creating the advisory board for youth and other stakeholders will give space for youth with lived experience of foster care to have a voice within the system. The increased oversight from the advisory board will help the office to better define its objectives and evaluate its impact. These are our children. They became ours when we separated them from their families. We owe them a duty of care just as strongly as we do for the children in our very own homes. The fundamental truth is that children are children, and they should have an expectation that adults will take care of them. But I've repeatedly seen at the personal level, and now at the systems level, this is not happening. It is my sincerest hope that those of you in power or who are in a position to change this system, reflect deeply on our moral responsibility and the cost of our continued indifference. Please support the creation of an Office of the Ombudsperson for Foster Youth. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. And we have a question. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Hansen, Mr. Murphy. What's the age or general age or maybe average age at which children are frequently placed in foster homes?
Let's see, Mr. Murphy or Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair. The most frequent age are folks who are under five.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Representative Sandell.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is there any way to establish, or perhaps there already is, a trust fund for children who are placed in foster homes? So at age 21, when they age out of their foster placement, there's a... there's some accumulation of wealth that they can depend on?
I'll allow the question, but Representative Sandell, please try to limit it to the scope of the bill. Mr. Murphy, do you have an answer for that?
There currently doesn't exist a structure of support in that way, but I love the idea. And one of the ways that this could also be achieved is something through extended foster care. Right now, you age out at 21. Other states have done this, but they have extended that timeline. And they're, you know, what what we know is that between the ages of 18 and 26, parents who, on average in the United States, transfer about $60,000 to their children. Foster youth do not have someone saving for them, do not have someone to call, even for $500 in a emergency. And so I think that would go a long ways to help. I would love to be in contact about ways to figure out how to best do that.
I think that's a great idea, Mr. Murphy. Connect with Representative Sandell, please. I encourage that. Not seeing any more questions. Representative Hansen. Oh, here we go. Representative Albright, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing the bill. There's a lot in here to like, so just kind of a few clarifying questions, if you would be indulging me. I note that the ombudsman is directly reporting to the governor. That is not typical of a relationship between an ombudsperson and the agency. Can you help me understand why that provision was made so?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Murphy, if you'd like to weigh in on this too, I would invite you to weigh in on this, because this bill is a result of the community discussing different options that were available, and that was the language that came through there. I'm a freshman, so I'm still new here and learning how some things work. And so I'm definitely open to having the conversation about, you know, potentially looking at that a second time. We have another committee stop, and we do have some planned amendments too. So Representative Albright, if you'd like to connect with me, I would love to talk about that. But Mr. Murphy, if you have anything else to add.
Mr. Murphy?
Thank you, Chair. The answer that I would provide for this is that this is modeled after several other states that also have an ombuds office. This is in part to create a office structure that allows the office to be supported and have direct connections with those who might be able to create change, while creating a clear line of independence from the Department of Human Services, in which they would have significant oversight of, just given that, you know, foster care exists within the Department of Human Services. I don't think there was any deep intention for any one particular office. There certainly could have been a structure that put it in MMB, but this was the most clear, direct, and, you know, efficient and affordable way to structure the office according to the research staff that we work with, the nonpartisan staff.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the author, Representative Hansen. A question related to your last stop in committee, where DHS testified that this bill would not directly address issues related to equity and race, but yet that is one of the proponents that you cite in the bill itself. How would you respond to that after having heard that in an earlier committee?
Thank you, Representative
Hansen.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. The way that I heard that question asked was maybe a little bit different. There was a question in our last committee about other ombudspersons that are specifically directed, and their mission and vision is to address the needs of families of certain races. And so this particular office helps, would address, you know, kids from all races. And so I would refer folks back to that testimony just to hear that whole conversation. Just for the sake of time, I know, Madam Chair, we're kind of running low.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I'll just add to this. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen. Go ahead. There's a delay, okay. So you got cut off. Go ahead.
That's okay. Sorry about that. So I think it's important for us when we talk about how do we achieve equity, how do we strive for equity, how do we work towards goals that promote equity? And I said this in my last committee, too. The best approach is an interdisciplinary. It's one where we look at things from a holistic perspective, where we see the whole person as a part of a community, as a little part of a family, and making sure that we're addressing those needs on the family level, which I think a youth foster ombudsperson would provide for folks in the foster system.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, having worked with the other ombuds offices, that, you know, they have a huge caseload. So this would be very helpful to focus on children in foster care. I really appreciate the work that Mr. Murphy's doing with Representative Hansen. Representative Albright.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a closing comment. I do note that there is no current Senate author. So if in Representative Hansen's closing comments, she could just address that. And I would remark that you often say, you know, if you had a superpower, what would it be? As this bill is written, I think you'd want to be the ombudsperson for youth and foster youth because of all the provisions and the Kevlar protection that this office has. So moving forward, Representative Hansen, I would just certainly urge you to consider the accountability that this office would possess because you are surrounding it with some of the most incredible protections. And lines of authority of any ombudsperson we've witnessed. So be careful of what you provide to someone at their own consequence as you move forward and consider the accountability measures for that office, please.
Representative Hansen, I'm not seeing any other questions. Do you want to maybe answer those and then conclude? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. We do have a Senate author. There was a yellow jacket issue that I think everybody here has run into at some point in time, but the jackets have been delivered, and Mr. Murphy, correct me, but I believe it's Senator Housley will be carrying this bill on the Senate side, so we just appreciate that collaboration. And I think as far as this being a very well-protected ombudsperson, I think that's excessively fitting because that's exactly what these kids need, and that's exactly what this population needs. Is somebody to have that role and ability to step up for them in ways that they may not have ever had. So I stand by that, and I think that this is a good decision for us to move forward with and to consider as a state, even if it is innovative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I know Representative Hansen loves to work across the aisle with members, so I know there was some concern about the reporting structure, so I know she would be open to working with you, Representative Albright, before it gets to judiciary. So with that, members, Representative Hansen is going to renew her motion to re-refer House File 3845 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And members, this will be a roll call vote. So Ms. Hansen, please take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Albright, aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Burkle, aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Noor?
Nor aye.
Nor aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Thank you, sir. Chair Schultz, 17 ayes and 2 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and thank you, members. So the motion prevails, and House File 3845 is on its way to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you, Mrs. Rep. Hansen and Mr. Murphy, for your testimony. Okay, next up, we have House File 3865. My motion is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Vice Chair Bonner, why don't you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to talk
about
this bill.
Representative Bonner, can you speak up a little or move closer to your mic, please?
All right, I'll move a little closer. Hopefully that helps. Madam Chair and members, the Direct Care and Treatment Program serves approximately 1,200 patients per year through an array of residential and treatment programs, serving people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and chemical dependency. Direct Care and Treatment, or DCT, directly supports the work of 2,400 clinicians in about 200 DCT locations. Over time, the program has been steadily implementing and upgrading their electronic medical record system, also called EMR, including the most recent upgrade to Avatar NX in 2018. Avatar provides the acute care behavioral health component best suited to the direct care and treatment needs and the communities they serve. It was chosen for its cost effectiveness and range of capabilities. The current system serves as a good foundation. With the full implementation, will provide DCT the full spectrum of a fully functional EMR and EHR, or electronic health record. While the foundation has been laid, the program is on its way to complete many of its phase one goals for the fully functional EMR system. DHS and their Minute partners require some additional resources to complete the work and shorten the timelines to fully meet the MDH goal to have their healthcare facilities all included in the EMR, or with a fully functioning EMR. The timelines for completion is set for summer of 2025, which will provide sufficient time to complete phase one of the EMR and to make good progress on phase two, which is a full electronic health records management system. It should be noted as well that failure to comply with state or federal regulations could pose a risk to the state or could result in fines, making it all the more important to get this done. So why is the work so vital to the DCT program, the clinicians, and the Minnesotans they serve? First and foremost, it's about patients. A fully functioning EMR from end to end provides safer care for both inside and outside of the state-operated behavioral health care system. Within DCT, clinicians can provide the best possible care when they can quickly access the most accurate, up-to-date information about patients and clients. Further, anyone under DCT's care may also receive care outside of the system. This requires information be shared between DCT and treatment providers to provide continuity of care and to ensure that clinicians have the full history and understanding of the patient. It improves safety, quality of care, and patient outcomes, as well as others outside of the system will benefit, including federal and state regulatory entities, and the legislature will benefit from DCT's ability to provide more detailed and robust audits and data requests using a more comprehensive system. Counties and courts will benefit as managing patient and client civil commitment proceedings takes extensive coordination between all three partners. Finally, the healthcare system statewide will benefit because of the ability to share patient records completely and quickly will be improved. With that, members, I will mention to you that the proposal on the table today is for $16.59 million. That is $8.91 million in FY23 and $7.68 in 2024. This covers 16 staff members for Minute who are actually working on doing the development of the project and moving it forward, as well as 9 staff members for DCT for a total of 25. You will find in your packets an additional piece of material that lists the roadmap for this project, as well as some basic FAQs that I thought members would most appreciate being able to have that additional information. I do not have testifiers, but I do have with me today Dr. Stevens, who is a specialist in analytics, Carrie Briones from DHS, as well as Dan Storktrump and Mila Joshi from DHS as well, who've been working closely on the project to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Thank you for all the work you're doing in this area. We really appreciate your expertise. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Bonner. First question, and I have three. The first of which is, this project has been underway for 14 years. Why has it taken so long to complete the task that the legislature instructed the agencies to put together?
Representative Bonner.
So I've been looking at speaking with folks in there, and certainly I'll allow DHS to weigh in on this as well. They actually do, just to be clear, they do have a functioning EMR system that is in place and it is currently being used. The problem is that there are certain components that they need to be fully fully operational, have all the components that they really need that are not quite there yet. And while they've made significant progress, particularly in the last couple of years by the upgrade in 2018 and under the direction of their new CEO, there are a few components that they need to complete in order to have full integration. And I think that the resources that we're discussing here will help them to speed up that timeline to make sure that they meet all regulatory and compliance guidelines and really allow this to be fully functional across the system.
And Representative Bonner,
if DHS wants to speak.
Yeah, I'll let them speak if someone wants to unmute and introduce themselves. Mr. Storkamp?
Good morning.
Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed.
For the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Director of Operations Services for Direct Care and Treatment. Madam Chair, Representative Albright, Direct Care and Treatment has been implementing our EMR for several years, as you've noted. Within the resources that we've had, we've been able to expand to a certain level, but we've just not been able to meet the requirements that are needed for meaningful use or for the new Cures Act. And the new Cures Act is going into place here in 2022, and that's the one that's requiring a lot more of the interoperability, where we've been really focusing on our EMR system and getting out of paper. I think we're about 60% out of paper today. We're hoping to get additional modules to get those additional items out of paper as well.
Thank you for that. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question number two. And to Mr. Storkamp, so you've had a system in place, and one of the questions that we always are very keenly aware of is when you're creating a new data set, particularly for the privacy and the security of the information that is provided by the individuals that come through your doors. So my question to you is, this is very sensitive information. How are you protecting it? And what audit trail are you providing going forward? And I just have one follow-up, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Storkamp.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. Direct Care and Treatment actually has a complete process in place for managing health records, both in paper and electronic. We know exactly who's going in and seeing what or what they're doing within those records. As we move into interoperability, we need to ensure that the clients provide consent in that process before any information is shared outside of our realm, as well as having an audit and tracking process in place that would know who got what information when in that process. It's a foundational piece that needs to be put in place, where we've got it today in our current system, but as we move to interoperability, there are elements that need to be added to ensure that that protection is there.
Thank you, Mr. Storkamp. Representative Albright, final question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this is to a broader question, and then maybe, you know, for you to weigh in as well, Madam Chair, but I see that this was referred to us, and it may be as a precedent for the program being underway already rather than laying it over. Would this not be appropriate to be sent to judiciary with regard to the ongoing systems upgrades, particularly with regard to audit trail and privacy information databases? It's a question that I think is pertinent because of what we said or heard on the Hansen bill, moving it to judiciary, but I'll wait for my question to be answered.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I don't believe judiciary thought they needed to hear it. Representative Bonner, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I can say that I think most of the modules that are being put in place, there's already a well-established process around some of the data compliance elements and protections. And so we're not creating anything new in that respect. We're simply updating the system to add additional functionality. So I would not expect that they would likely need to hear it. But certainly, you know, if they feel, the chair feels that they need to, we'd be happy to take a stop there. But I don't suspect that is required.
I don't think it's required either, but we will Representative Mueller is shaking her head. Representative Mueller, do you want to add anything as a member of Judiciary?
Madam Chair, just as Vice Chair, obviously can't speak for the Chair, but this doesn't touch on Chapter 13, and that's usually sort of what would trigger for us a bill that would need to be heard. So just looking at the language, I don't think this is a bill that, the Judiciary Committee would need.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. I love that immediate answer. Okay, Representative Albright, that was your third question. Did you have a closing comment?
No, Madam Chair. But I would appreciate just an observation at the conclusion of our business for the committee today.
Okay. I will just say that 16 years ago, we didn't have these off-the-shelf products that we have now. So I think things are moving in the right direction. And I appreciate Representative Bonner bringing this bill forward. Final closing comments, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will tell you, you know, as with many of these things, I do serve on the Technical Advisory Committee, formerly Blue Ribbon Commission on IT, as well as the Vice Chair of the Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity. And I've spent over 20-some years in IT, including direct software project management. So I can tell you that I put both Dan and Mila and the team through their paces on this bill, had numerous working sessions to make sure that I felt very confident that they had a good working plan, that their process improvement strategy was solid, and that they really are taking the right approach to this. I know we've had some issues here in the past, but I wanted to be very careful and make sure that we were on the right path. So I have been working with them extensively to ensure that that happens. And of course, they have done an excellent job of letting me litter them with questions and concerns and copious amounts of conversation back and forth to ensure that that is in fact happening. So I appreciate their dedication and their patience with me on those hours and hours of conversation, and hope that we can get this through and get this on track.
Well, we appreciate your wonderful expertise in IT and information systems, Representative Bonner, and I see that Representative Elkins is on the bill as well. So he's also, I know, our resident IT expert. So we appreciate his work. Okay, members, with that, House File 3845 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Our final bill on the agenda is House File 4301. I'm going to make the motion to lay over House File 4301 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. This is Chair Fisher's bill. Chair Fisher, would you like to explain your bill to us?
Good morning, Chair Schultz, and thank you for the opportunity to present House File 4301. This is a bill that comes from the Department of Human Services, and it does a variety of different things. Is number one, it addresses an issue that is currently out there regarding license suspensions, is that if there's an investigation going on, sometimes the investigation takes longer than 60 days, or excuse me, than 90 days. And right now, the way the statute is written is after 90 days, they would have to allow the license to continue back in operation, even though there could be very serious charges out there or maltreatment occurring. And so what this does, it allows law enforcement to complete their investigation and at the same time keep the suspension in place to protect people who might be receiving those services. Some of the other things that this bill addresses is it addresses the paperwork issue. This kind of picks up from where the Uniform Standards and Behavioral Health was working on last year. There are a number of areas where there was a lot of duplicate paperwork going on. So it streamlines the paperwork option of it so that people don't have to spend as much time filling out paperwork and streamlining it so that it can be much more efficient. Another thing it does is it helps address some of the workforce issues out there. Some of the requirements that were in here before would prevent people from having any addiction issues or dealing with addiction issues from providing services. And so often when you're dealing with people who are people in the peer area, peer counselors, those type of positions, you can occasionally have people who occasionally have addiction issues. And if say somebody ended up say getting a having an addiction issue, whether it was to alcohol or drugs during the time that they're working there, they would have to lose their job and be put out. And instead, what this allows is for some flexibility, allowing the employer to take a look at this too. Is this a situation where we have to remove the person and that type of thing? So it addresses a variety of things back and forth. It's one that has been vetted that Department of Human Services has talked to the providers in the area. There has been no pushback that I'm aware of. I don't have any testifiers, but I do have quite a few people from the department available because this is a rather long bill and very technical, and they'd be very good at answering some of the questions I probably won't be able to.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Are there any questions on the bill? Representative Albright?
Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, first question is, this bill would certainly be in the strike zone, your wheelhouse and your committee. I'm curious as to why it wasn't re-referred there first.
Chair Fisher?
Thank you. As I was taking a look at it, it was very technical in nature, and it was one of those things that I didn't think that we would have to bring down to our committee.
Thank you. Chair Fisher, it's a technical bill. Usually the divisions will just, especially if bills need work with members. Is that correct, Chair Fisher?
That is correct. Typically what I like to do is where I know there's going to be a lot of work on bills, I'd rather take those in. And we've had several bills like that where we're spending two or three meetings on the time working on bills that really need the work. And when something like this is very technical, I'd rather just try to get that straight through so we can spend on the time on the bills that have to move forward and need the work before we can get them forward.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fisher, I know you to be a very diligent legislator. I think it's unfortunate that your committee did not be afforded an opportunity to look at it, even though it was of a technical nature. I think a number of sets of eyes from both sides of the aisle might have benefited from the support that you're certainly looking for this, with this bill going forward. I will note that you are removing the personnel policy requirements for staff with substance use issues. Current law requires that they, have certain periods of substance-free periods. Could you speak to why you're removing that language?
Chair Fisher, would you like to answer that, or would you like DHS to respond?
I will have DHS. I think I know the reason, but I'd like DHS to give the accurate answer for that, please.
Okay, we have Keith Kegler. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation, and then please respond to the question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Keith Kogler. I'm with the Department of Human Services Licensing Division, and I'm a policy analyst.
Go ahead. Please proceed to answer, unless you need the question repeated.
No, I think I have a good understanding of the question. So in this bill, there's a number of different changes related to the requirements for personnel policies and other staffing requirements surrounding what we currently call problematic substance use. So the intention of all of this is to really streamline the requirements and to still require the provider or the license holder to have policies and procedures that appropriately address actions that they're going to take if a staff person has an issue with substances. That really references current existing standards in the Human Services Licensing Act, Chapter 245A. So you'll see that really everything tries to refer back to the existing requirements for license holders to have policies and procedures to address really chemical use problems of their staff persons. And all of these changes will hopefully have the same policy and procedure requirements for license holders that are in Chapter 245I, which are the Uniform Service Standards, so that providers of really up to six or seven different types of licenses and certifications can really just have one policies and procedures of how their program will address those substance use issues.
Thank you for that. Representative Albright.
I don't think I've got anything further, Madam Chair.
Okay, other questions for members? Not seeing any. Chair Fisher, closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Thank you to the committee for the opportunity to present 4301. I think we've gotten a good idea of what it covers. I will just recommend that we continue on in the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. So House File 4301 will be laid over for possible inclusion in Human Services Finance Bill. I just to clarify, Chair Fisher, you did not have an amendment, did you? And it's, oh, you're muted.
No, I did not.
Okay, sorry. I forgot to ask, but just making sure. Thank you, Chair Fisher.
You're welcome.
Okay, members, we will be meeting tomorrow and Thursday and possibly Friday morning. Yep, Representative Albright, sorry, I forgot.
Madam Chair, go ahead. Apologize for interviewing. Madam Chair, this is really more of a sense that there's very little, if any, disagreement that, you know, we are through the worst of this COVID. And to get back to normal, one of those very appropriate situations that we meet in person. And I'm having a hard time finding or seeking out a compelling reason why we're not. And so I'm urging you, because of the work that we have to do before the end of session, and because of the need for being in person to do that in a real-time setting, I'm just urging you to find and solicit out the opportunity to meet in person. For the benefit of the people that we serve. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. There's nothing more than I would like to do as to have these committees in person. I'm spending a lot more time at the Capitol. But what I'm told is it's not the necessarily COVID-19, but a staffing issue right now. And we also have to remind people that children under 5 are not yet eligible for vaccination, and we have staff with children under 5. But I will be an advocate with you, Representative Albright, to see what we can do, and let's work together on that. Any other questions from members? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So members, we are gonna be meeting Friday. That is the first deadline. We have an 8:30 a.m. hearing, and we have several bills on the agenda. So please put that on your calendar, and you should have received that invitation in your inboxes. With that, members, I will see everyone tomorrow. Thank you for the great questions, and thank you for all our testifiers today. With that, we are adjourned.